Thursday almost makes you want to run away. Thursday, such a crazy, lazy day.
Hey, it's another Lazy Crazy Thursday, the afternoon show. And I'm here with
Jake Ebel.
Jake, the intern Ebel, I might add. And the lovely, as always, hello, that's you.
Oh, hi, I'm Ellen Thurston.
Hi, Ellen.
The co-hostess of this program. And we are going to move right into our first talk with Kevin Lippert, who's here from the Princeton Architectural Press, who have recently opened a branch office here on Warren Street in Hudson.
That's correct.
So welcome to Hudson.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me up here in the rain.
Well, I think a lot of people are eager to know more about the press. So,
well, first of all, why is it called Princeton Architectural Press if you're here in New York City and
we're
Hudson?
Trying to make it as confusing as possible.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I started the press when I was a student at Princeton, and because it was the name of a town in addition to being the name of the university, I used the name Princeton in order to make it sound maybe more momentous than it really was. And then in the mid-80s, moved the press to New York City. So it was Princeton Architectural Press actually in New York City. And then in the mid-90s, we decided to expand what we do beyond just architecture. So we now publish in a wide variety of areas, architecture, graphic design, typography, and what we call visual culture. So illustrated books that we think are interesting. So it's not in Princeton, and we don't just, we do more than just architecture. So it's
there you go.
New York and Hudson books, illustrated visual books.
I've noticed you haven't really mentioned Hudson yet on your blog or your website. Is that going to happen?
I'm the webmaster, and
ah.
So as soon as I get around to that, we'll get there. We were waiting to we're opening a small retail shop down at 202 204 Warren. And we had a very soft, I think it's so soft, maybe we should call it a limp opening on Winter Walk night. And once we get everything set up in there, some shelves built, that's where we're going to have an official opening and some sort of event to welcome our neighbors.
And I should point out that among their books are many books that you might call giftable. They're not all hardcore academic studies. There's some very nice guides to various cities, the signs of cities. There's some other kind of things I'm thinking about.
Well, we have a big range. We even have now a whole line which we call Paper and Goods, which is going to be the name of the little shop.
Ah.
Of stationery products, and that includes note cards, journals, our best-selling pencils. This year, our number one best-selling item has been a set of colored pencils that we did from the designer Louise Feely, and she's an Italophile, so she called them Tutti Frutti.
So she's the one who does the city guides, right?
She did. Yeah, that's right. And she did a little guide for us, actually, the Cognoscenti's Guide to Florence.
Hmm. That's for you, Ellen.
Yes.
Because we know you're among the cognoscenti.
Is that the female or the male version of cognoscenti?
I think that's plural.
I think that's plural,
the
right?
Plural.
Yes.
Oh, among the. Oh, thank you. Reminds me of a joke. Never mind.
Oh, no, not the Martini Martinez joke.
No, no. A German walks into a bar and orders a martini. And the bartender says, dry? And he says, no, I only want one.
Oh, dear.
Sorry.
Excellent, Ellen.
Moving along.
I had no idea there were variations on your martini jokes.
There's a book idea right there.
Right, yeah.
The bartender says.
Oh,
so,
you know,
I know a lot of your stuff is visual culture, so I was kind of surprised to see that Howard K. Smith, Howard Smith book. How did that come about? For listeners, he was a big interview. He had a great column in the Village Voice. And I recall he also co-hosted a show on NET back in the day.
Was it, or PLJ?
No, TV show.
Oh, I don't know about the TV show. He had a radio show.
Yeah, PLJ.
All the great musicians and many also movie stars, political figures, activists on the radio show. And these tapes from those interviews were all stuck away in a closet. And somebody who was a friend of somebody who used to work at the press discovered these tapes and transcribed them. So that came about just through personal connection. And we have a small series of books, which we call Words of Wisdom, which are quote books. So we did one, The Architect Says, The Designer Says, The Filmmaker Says, and then we did one called The Chef Says. And they're just quotes from, hopefully, kind of humorous quotes. Well, next time.
The Bartender Says,
coming soon. So we sort of dabbled a little bit in music with that book. And Smith Tapes is just, I don't know if you've read it or seen it. I'm glad.
I saw it just the other day. It's Buddy Dog right here on Warren Street.
It's fantastic reading. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. I used to love his column in the Village Voice.
Yeah.
You were talking about the quote books, the quotation books, and do books like that sort of subsidize your more academic books? Or, I mean, you don't have to go into too much detail about that.
Well, without going into too much detail, the quick answer is yes, yeah. Absolutely. We do. We try to keep the balance between more serious academic books, which are books that's how the press started.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those sell better than you might think because they get adopted for course text use at various universities and colleges. Actually, our best-selling book of all time is the book Thinking with Type, which is a small introduction to typography, and that is used very extensively in introduction to design, introduction to type classes. So that's not a very sexy illustrated book, but that's done really well.
You say in your catalog, we excel at publishing books that defy easy categorization.
Well, let me give you an example of a book that's coming out in the spring. And this is a sequel to a book that we published called The Toaster Project. This was a young design student at the London College of Art, and he wanted to make a toaster completely from scratch. When I say completely, he wanted to harvest his own raw materials.
Mm-hmm.
So he dug up his own quartz to make a heating element. He dug up his own copper to make wire. And he wanted to synthesize his own plastic out of crude oil, so he called British Petroleum, but they had another problem to deal with in the Gulf of Mexico, so they put him off. But he hobbled together this thing, and I think it worked for a few seconds. It warmed up a piece of toast. I'm not sure it actually toasted a piece of toast. But we published basically his illustrated biography of how he made this thing, and he's a very engaging, very entertaining writer, a very witty young fellow. And that was a big hit for us. That's the only book author we've ever gotten on the Colbert Report.
That's where I saw him. I knew I was familiar with that book.
So he had a...
Did that start as a blog?
No, it was a thesis project, but I think there's a blog. He's a pretty active blogger. And then after the success of this book, and he did a book tour for us and then some in Europe, then the BBC offered him a TV show. They wanted him to make a toaster a week. They were going to pick an appliance or a home electronics thing and have him try and make it. And that didn't work out so well, as you can imagine. So he needed some time off, and his idea of taking some time off was to transform himself into a goat. So he studied the physiology of goats. He talked to goat herds, to animal psychologists, and he created a plywood exoskeleton that forces him to walk like a goat, a prosthetic stomach that with the aid of a pressure cooker allows him to digest grass. And he spent months studying everything he could about goats, and then he connected with a herd of goats, and together they crossed the Alps.
My Lord.
So where do you shelve that book? I mean, it's kind of a design story because it talks a lot about the physiology of how goats walk, how they digest grass. So maybe there's a bit of anatomy in there. But it's a great story, but it's a crazy story. And a lot of our books like that are, those are the most interesting books I think we do. It's difficult for bookstores to figure out where to shelve them.
Well, there's that great new book you have about the fellow over near Woodstock who created his own...
Marwan Call.
Marwan Call. I don't remember the name of it, but I saw the documentary about him at one point.
Yeah.
That's an amazing story.
An amazing
you want to tell
story,
us
yeah.
that?
Sure. As a young man who was beaten up outside of a bar in Woodstock in a bar fight, the exact details probably too long to go into, but he was kicked to the edge of death and left abandoned on the street. And when he came to in the ICU, he had absolutely no memory of the first 38 years of his life. He'd lost any memory of who he was, the fact that he had been married, his service in the Navy, and so on and so forth. So as a sort of art therapy project, he created a miniature scale village, which he calls Marwin Call, in his backyard in Woodstock, using G.I. Joe figures, dolls, toys, toy tanks, and it with incredible precision and accuracy. So the story came out in the New York Times. Somebody passed him on the side of the road. He was towing a Jeep, a plastic Jeep with a string. And they said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm trying to get the right amount of mud on his Jeep." Because from Marwin Call to Liège was 25 kilometers. So he figured he had to walk this Jeep 25 kilometers through the mud in Woodstock. So he creates this imaginary village where everybody gets along. So you're welcome to Marwin Call if you're British or German or American or French or Russian, as long as you play by the rules. And he said that, and of course the SS infiltrate, but Mark Hogenkamp, who was basically his alter ego and who's the hero of, he creates a series of photographs that are very much like comic book tableaus. So the hero of Marwin Call routs out the SS guy and executes them many, many times. So it's as Mark said in the book, that this was his chance to basically get back at the guys that left him for dead in Woodstock. But it's an incredible work of outsider art.
Yeah.
And yeah, the photographs and the stories are really, really amazing, really compelling. So that's another, is that biography? Is that art therapy? Is that outsider art? Just human drama. It's kind of all those things.
So going back a bit, what made you decide to become a publisher? Did you start as a publisher, or did you work your way through the publishing industry?
I was in architecture school at a time when we were being asked to go look at history. We called it precedent. But really, it was to sort of help people like me, who maybe weren't going to be the best architects in the universe, to go see what had been done in the past, and specifically during the Renaissance and Renaissance Rome. And so there was a library book called the Edifice de Roma Moderne, The Buildings of Modern Rome, that was a large format series of engravings of the buildings of Renaissance Rome. And I had this idea that if I were to do a reduced size edition, it would be useful for me and my classmates. And I had, I don't know if you remember Jimmy Carter, right before the election, he came up with the guaranteed student loan. So pretty much every student in America got a check for $5,000. Not that he was trying to buy the election, but I used my $5,000 check. I looked up printer in the Yellow Pages, and I found a great small family-run printing business outside of Philadelphia. And ironically, the library, who would barely let you touch the book or photocopy it, had no problem with me taking it out of the library and running it down to Philadelphia. And we cut a couple of plates out of the book. We made some negatives, and we made some printing plates, and the guy knocked a job off the press, and he showed me how you print a book, and on a signature, how you fold the paper. I knew nothing about bookmaking or printing, but it was very magical and very fast. Architecture was slow and painful, and basically in an hour or two, we'd created the beginning of a book. So I ran back to the school, and I photographed this book using the photography lab at the school, and by the time I graduated, I had done three of these reprints, and I graduated in the mid-80s, right into the middle of Ronald Reagan's recession, which most people have forgotten about since we sort of deified Ronald Reagan. But unemployment in the mid-80s was 10%, so there were no architecture jobs to be had. I had this little business on my hands, and I figured it was easier than looking for an architecture job. And the rest, here I am still doing it. It's 35 years later, and it's a great... extremely lucky to have kind of fallen into this, but it's not a, I didn't know. And I often say, and I think it's true, that ignorance was my biggest asset, because I didn't know what a kind of dopey business it is. It's publishing is a bad business. Publishing obscures books about architecture is even tougher.
You know, it's really interesting. I think this way about artists too. Books keep being published and published and published in spite of the internet and all of that, and the way things are changing. What happens to all those books? They don't get burned or destroyed for the
most
part.
A lot of them get pulped.
Yes.
Is a nice word.
They get pulped, but
they get run through giant shredders.
But, you know, we all have these libraries. We all say, you know, I need to get rid of some of my books. And you put them in a yard sale or you give them to the library or someplace else. They just are proliferating.
Yeah,
so
I think it's
how do you handle that?
100,000 books are published every year. So there's a lot of publishing. And that's just physical books. I'm not talking about e-books.
Yeah,
and,
people still want to buy books.
Have you moved heavily into e-books at all?
No, we have. We started doing PDF versions of our books a long time ago with an academic library aggregator called ebrary.com. So many of our books are available through ebrary in PDF format. And we've done 100 or more that are available on the Kindle, but... the books that we make, if you've seen them, or I hope you'll come down to our shop and take a look at them, and that's maybe my architecture background. We're very interested in the design of the book, the look and feel of the book, the quality of the book, and just a lot of that just doesn't translate to a Kindle.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking about the book industry, that illustrated books or books of illustration or books of art, photography books, they're going to exist long after books that are simply print, you know what I mean? Well, it just doesn't reproduce well on a Kindle.
No, it just doesn't work.
That's the main reason, I guess.
It just doesn't work.
But so to bring us up to the present, what made you decide to open a branch in Hudson?
Well, I've had a weekend house in Ghent since 1999, and my wife and I, 15 months ago, a year ago, August 2014, decided that we'd had enough of Manhattan and it was time to move up here full time. We have a 4-year-old daughter. It's time for her to start school, and the choices in New York were few and expensive. Somebody recommended a great school up here, so she goes to Open Meadow School in Harlemville, and we just pulled the plug and moved up here. So I was doing a lot of commuting down to our office in the East Village 4 days a week on Amtrak, which is why your Amtrak stock went up so much in the last year.
Ellen, is that where you get all that extra cash?
Sure.
And... let's see, fortuitously or maybe fortuitously, we lost the lease on half of the space. We had 2 floors and a brownstone in the East Village. We lost the lease on one of those. So we were forced with the problem of finding new office space. And also we'd kind of outgrown that space. And one day when I was driving back from the train station, I drove up Warren Street and I saw a for rent sign at the corner of 2nd and Warren. And I thought, aha, well, this would solve a lot of problems. So we rented that space, and we opened on September 1.
So do you go into the city office much anymore?
Not so much. One day a week, which seems like plenty, honestly. I hope nobody from New York is streaming us right now.
So how much of your staff will you actually bring up here?
Well, at the moment, there are 5 of us that moved up. And... I mean, the reason for, I think, in a nutshell, the cost of doing business here is lower. It's no surprise that our rent is a lot lower here than it is in Manhattan. And the cost of living is a lot lower. So for the first time ever, my wife and I are living within our means. And that's a really exciting feeling.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to dip into savings to pay off our credit card bill. And if you are a young person working in publishing, which I hate to say is not a highly... compensated field,
right.
And you're living in Manhattan, I don't really know how you make it work. You live in Inwood with 5 or 6 roommates, and then you don't have money to do the things that you're in Manhattan to do. You can't afford to go to MoMA or out to dinner or go see some music. Whereas I think on the same salary in Hudson, you could actually have a life. You might be able to have an apartment or a car.
People seem to have 3 jobs, in many of them.
New York, yeah. So I assumed that among our younger staff that this idea would hold a lot of interest, but I was kind of wrong about that. A lot of them want to stay in the city because they want to live and work in New York, and they're at that point in their life. Some people can't move up because they have spouses with jobs or they have kids in school. But there's a kind of older, my age and older, they have a great the idea has more appeal because these are people that may own property in New York, so they can sell high down there and they can buy lower up here and put the money away for retirement. So
this was a problem that Modern Farmer had when they set up here.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the young sort of media savvy types didn't really want to leave the city. and felt that they were out here in the boondocks.
Yeah. Although there was an article not so long ago on Modern Farmer that actually used to convince my owners. I forwarded it to them. And it was almost a paid advertorial. It was mm-hmm. with the new editor of Modern Farmer saying that it had been really easy to recruit staff to move to Hudson.
Yeah, well, the new editor, that's probably true. Yeah. It was the old crowd that was...
Things have changed.
I always thought it was funny that the editor-in-chief who complained the most about being here eventually went to the magazine Fast Company. It's like, I guess that's what you want. You know? I mean, you don't really want the slow life of Hudson.
Well, you know, the economic development people always talk in terms of jobs, jobs, jobs. And do you envision creating new jobs?
We do. We are... I'm just finishing tomorrow our salary budget for next year, and we're hoping to add, I think, 3 positions next year. So if there are any listeners who have interest in publishing, they should send their resumes along to us. So, yeah, we're going to add some staff, and we have room here. We're out of room in New York because we lost 50% of our space, so people are kind of crammed in like sardines down there.
Do the production jobs have to be in your city office, or can they be up here as well?
Our director of production is one of the people that's moving up here.
Okay.
So,
I know production engineer or whatever. I mean editor, I meant to say.
Okay, well, have him or her contact us. But, I mean, we love living up here. It's fantastic. We have no regrets. We were in the city on Tuesday for our New York City office party. And I asked my wife, I said, do you miss this at all? She said, nah, not at all. So we're really happy to be here. I think it's going to be good for the business. And it's surprising to me how many people have book ideas or have a creative background that have just walked in. The woman who made my coffee across the street turns out to be a children's book paper engineer. She has a Kickstarter for a children's pop-up book, she and a friend.
Do you mean Kim Bach?
I don't know. Nice young woman, blonde hair, at Verdigris.
Oh, at Verdigris. I don't know.
The guy, the man, Mid-Hudson Cable guy who came in to put in our internet, he had a book idea. So everybody seems to know somebody or have an idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's no secret. This is a town full of really creative people.
I'm a great proofreader.
Okay, and Ellen's going to do some proofreading for us. In fact, one of the things we want to set up...
You can get her cheap, too, by the way.
We want to set up a kind of open house where we'll invite people to bring in projects or ideas and sit down with an editor and just kind of bounce ideas around.
That's fantastic. And you're right. There are plenty of creative people here. It's been amazing to discover how many writers... I mean, quality writers, not just, kind of regional...
Yeah.
Yeah, you're a writer types. But there are plenty of real writers and editors who've either retired or moved up here full time. Mm-hmm. If you're not surprised, you will be surprised.
Yeah. And letterpress people, there seem to be several of those inbound, too. So.
Yeah, there's a... in fact, I just met somebody the other day who was a graphic designer in New York City. His name is Michelle Goldberg. I don't know if you know that name.
No.
But we got into a long conversation about Bruce Rogers. The famous typographist.
Yep.
And he's very interested in letterpress. And now there's a new printer doing all kinds of printing down at the L&B factory that Ellen interviewed.
Oh, it's called Inky Editions.
Yeah.
I don't know that much.
Yeah, you should take a look, go down there and make...
Where's L&B factory?
That's behind Basilica. Where the Basilica is?
I know
where
Basilica
is. It's that ugly factory building behind
right.
there.
Big,
right.
long, white building.
Uh-huh.
But it's inexpensive, relatively, right. and a lot of antique stores move
yeah,
in there.
Yeah, I've been to the antique stores.
And if you ever need, for example, if you had warehousing problems, that might be a place to consider. You know what I mean?
Okay.
And
all those unsold books.
There's also a brewery in
I saw
in
it going in. Yeah. Going in where the coffee place
yeah,
is.
Well, that's
right.
going to be their tasting room.
Okay.
The actual brewery is
in the, back.
Yeah.
In
fact, ladies and gentlemen, Jake Crittenden from the Hudson Brewery will be with us later on.
That's right.
My favorite two topics, books and beer.
There you go. The spotty dog man.
Well, I've given up the beer, actually.
Well,
I've grown up to wine.
Is there anything else we should be asking you about that's on your mind?
That's
on my mind.
How about mine?
And what about you?
I'm trying to figure out some book proposals, I got plenty.
As we said, yeah. Well, It's been great talking to
yeah,
you.
Yeah, thanks for coming
so
in.
Glad
it really is
you're
my
here.
Pleasure. And that
this
was
is very exciting.
You asked me earlier about Winter Walk, and we had a really warm reception from everybody that came into our little space, and people just were like, "We're so glad you're here," or "We heard you were opening an office or a store. So nice to have you in the neighborhood." So we felt, and also having you invite us here, we feel very, very welcomed into the community.
Absolutely.
And so I think this is going to be a really great move.
I could see it starting
press.
A trend too.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want my competitors kind of driving up
who
the
are
rent.
Your competitors? You know, what, Abrams Books is going to move? I mean, you don't really have a kind of a niche
publisher. We are a very niche publisher. Yeah. But Abrams is a minor competitor. Rizzoli, Fiden, those are the big,
yeah,
those
right.
sort of the big guys. But a lot of them have the same problem we have, which is it's just too damn expensive to do business
Absolutely.
In Manhattan. If you were going to start a publishing company, I said before, ignorance was my biggest asset. By the time I figured out this was a dumb business, it was too late. It was up and running. But if you did the way you're supposed to do and sit down and make a business plan and a budget, you would not start it in New York or San Francisco. It just makes no sense.
When I was on the periphery of the publishing industry.
What's that, the periphery? I'm on the periphery.
working for Kirkus Reviews.
Uh-huh.
And at one point they did as rents kept going up and up, they realized how much it cost just to have somebody sitting in the office there.
At Kirkus.
Yeah. So they basically got rid of everybody out of the office. And I think now, it's been a while, I think now they're not even in New York City anymore.
I have no idea.
As many places like
but
that.
A lot of publishers have, like Harper's has moved to Hoboken and Wiley. Well, Wiley's in Hoboken. Harper's is maybe moving to another, maybe to Jersey City. Mm. So I'm happy that we ran for... ran north.
There's a much better direction.
Rather than New Jersey. No offense to any New Jersey people listening. But
yeah, well, Frank Sinatra's not alive anymore, so don't worry.
He's the only one that matters.
Again, in the introduction to your catalog, you talk about the McAvoy Group. They're kind of like-minded publishers.
Well, McAvoy Group owns Chronicle Books, who is our distributor. And Chronicle has, for, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 years, created a very successful brand of books that are about design, highly designed, and really good value, good deal. Mm-hmm. And when they saw that the independent book trade was dissolving, they made a decision to try and find other places to sell books. So they created a lot of kind of giftable books that they sell in a lot of retail shops, mom and pop home decor stores, stationery stores, museum shops. And so what they've really grown by finding new outlets, new places to sell books. They distribute our books. And so McAvoy Group owns Chronicle. They own us. And they own a couple of other small
Mud
publishing
Puppy.
Companies. Mud Puppy Gallison. They're a stationery company based in Manhattan.
In fact, I think a lot of the few remaining independent bookstores rely on these kind of products to really help... You know,
yes.
underwrite everything else they do.
Yeah.
Of course, Spotty Dog came up with the great idea of also having beer.
Yeah. And wine. Now that you've graduated.
That's right. That's right. And, of course, art supplies. But they have a lot of these kind of giftable items that, if nothing
and
else, they subsidize.
And they can order anything, too.
Yeah.
I think that's what people forget.
Yeah.
Is that if you go into a store and you don't see a book, you can order it from them just as easily as you can order it from Amazon.
Sure.
I think I bought a Chronicle book just the other day, that James Ellroy book of L.A. police photographs. Did
I
you
don't
that?
Know. I don't know
it's
that.
It's really cool.
I don't
They're
know
all from 1953.
That could be them.
It's really cool.
Well, they publish
sure
about 350 books a year.
Yeah.
So,
they're good.
I can't keep up with everything they do.
Well, and what's your proposal, Ellen? You got a book in mind?
Besides
no.
The Bartender Says.
It's
funny.
The
you should say
said.
We had our Hudson office Christmas lunch yesterday at Kamea, and at the beginning of the wine list, they have several hilarious quotes about wine.
Uh-huh.
And somebody said, we should have, the Bartender Says, and add to these quotes.
There you go, Ellen. All your experience
The Bartender Says a lot. He often says, what are you doing here? You know, like the three-legged dog who walks into the bar. Why are you here? And he said, I'm looking for the man that shot my paw.
Oh, man. Okay.
What about the horse one with the long face?
The horse? Oh, why the long face? A horse walks into the bar. The bartender says, why the long face?
Well, Ellen, I think that proposal just got nixed. But we'll work on it.
We got to talk.
These are not my jokes.
We can hang out at bars more often and
the one I remember from yesterday was W.C. Fields saying, once during Prohibition, I was forced to live on nothing but food and water. So you go talk to Kamea. I have an iPhone photo of their wine quotes. Yeah. Combine them with your bartender says jokes.
Okay.
And you can have a book.
And we have
Chronicle published a book of 1,001 jokes everybody should know. And there's a whole bartender section. There's a chapter on blondes. There's a chapter on bartenders. So maybe there's a possibility for you. And they could sell more books than we can sell, I think.
Well, thanks for coming in. We've been talking
very
to
much.
Kevin Lippert, the publisher and CEO. Yes?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Of Princeton Architectural Press, a new office right here on Warren Street in Hudson. Half of their office will now be right down in the Broussard. It's called Broussard Building, or Brousseau or Broussard?
It was in a I'm not sure.
Brousseau. B-R-O-S-S-E-A-U.
No D at the end.
What was it before?
It was an apartment building.
Yeah.
I
and
thought it was...
the ground floor was what?
That's a good question. I don't
retail
know.
Of some sort, yeah. I think. I'm not sure if it the retail got added or, you know, the building was changed in some way. Hmm. But I thought it was where one of those newspapers called The Wasp and or the Hornet and all those.
Yeah, really? That's
were,
before my time now.
They were at the corner of 3rd and Warren.
Uh-huh.
This is 2nd and Warren, isn't it?
Yeah, we're at 2nd
yes,
and 2nd
and Warren.
Is it open to the public yet?
The
stop
shop,
by?
Yes.
Oh,
please,
okay.
Please come by. We have many of our holiday-related items on sale.
At there you go.
At
Christmas shopping right here on Warren Street.
At 204. At very good prices.
204.
So please come by.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for coming in. We're all excited. In fact, really, truly, that's not just smoke. My friends who live in Hudson are really excited about a publisher finally being here, you know. And,
well, we're really happy to be here. So I think it's going to be a really smart move. For us and
a game changer for Hudson.
Well, that's nice of you to say. Yeah. But we'll see. We'll talk again in a year.
Yep. Thanks again,
Thank
Kevin
you.
Lippert.
My pleasure.
And we're going to take a little break here. Jake, how about some music?
Sure thing. Here we go. This is Johnny Lang.